A very busy Thursday, June 8th, 2023 edition of Connecticut Today, right here on WICC. We welcomed CT169strong.org spokesperson Maria Weingarten to chat about the last-minute zoning bill that was okayed by the General Assembly. Heritage Foundation analyst Steve Bradbury gave us his thoughts on the Canadian wildfires. We welcomed onlyinbridgeport.com blogger Lenny Grimaldi for his weekly update, and I had some thoughts to kick off the show on the just-concluded legislative session in Hartford. This show, along with Lisa Wexler in the midday and Melissa in the morning, we are keeping you folks, particularly you Fairfield County folks. I know it's a blanket law for Connecticut, or the debate was, but let's not pull punches here. A lot of this controversy over zoning squarely aimed at the beginning, at least at Fairfield County. So we kept you informed on this as best we could as things were shifting almost hour by hour toward the end of the session. One bill did pass. It's got some rather innocuous stuff in it that I think a lot of people can agree on. But then what else is in it? CT 169 Strong, the major group trying to keep people involved and informed as to what's going on. Maria Weingarten joins us once again. Maria, hi, it's Paul. Good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, good afternoon. Doing well. Thank you.
Thanks, Maria. Okay, so what ended up passing here, Maria? I see some innocuous stuff about, you know, mandating a walkthrough and some fines for, you know, non-compliant landlords. So that's kind of stuff,
right,
that people can agree on. But from the zoning scenario here, what can you tell my listeners?
Well, there was one section in there related to fair share. And so we know the fair share bill, we've been tracking it all along, and it had enormous mandates on it. But what this bill did was essentially truncate it and to just take the step one, which meant that it's legitimizing a methodology for creating a fair share. And it makes assumptions, and it really doesn't consider any of the boots on the ground factors that may make it much more challenging for one town versus another. Like if you take an Easton that has a lot of reservoirs, that doesn't, you know, that has a 70% watershed, trying to give them a high allocation number is much harder than some other towns, and there's no factors put into play in the methodology. So we have yet to see what will come of it. It's just right now they're saying that they're going to figure out that the secretary of OPM will be in charge of creating the methodology. There is some detail in the bill, which is the same detail that was in from the last 2 years when the bill was rejected, because then they told people how many units it would be. And everyone who saw it and knew it said, this is crazy. You can't possibly allocate these numbers. So I guess the strategy this year was to not tell anybody what's in the bill and pass it first. And here we are.
So these unit numbers then, Maria, who is actually, I mean, it's OPM? I mean, so in other words, when a number of units is handed down to a municipality, if that's how it's going to work, can there be any discussion about that? Or do we even have any idea of a structure of how this might work?
No, we don't. And they've left all that for round two. So round two is when they'll decide on implementation, if there's any way to, to protest or to, you know, appeal what your numbers are, any sort of things that we saw in the past bills, things like allowing housing developers and housing advocates to have standing, legal standing in sue towns for development, for lawsuits, and get lawsuit reimbursement costs, and also to sue for damages. So those sort of things, and also things like losing all of your local zoning. If you've not developed the amount of units in the set time the state was telling you, they were going to say, okay, all of your zoning is gone, and we're going to mandate anywhere with sewer 20 units an acre and anywhere else as much as your well and your septic can handle. So that's going to be round two, probably. We've already gotten a preview of it. That's the bill that they put forward this year. But again, they truncated off that step two. So right now it's just allocation. And those allocations, we will not see much about. It remains to be seen how, you know, they're calling it a study. There is no word study anywhere listed on there. It basically says that the total will be that the allocation will be decided by the secretary of OPM in consultation with others, including housing advocates, including experts, and but it's incredibly vague. So it's concerning.
So, Maria Weingarten, it sounds like this is the same sort of structure here that caused the blowback on one of these bills regarding climate policy, where enough people said, no, you cannot simply allow the deep commissioner to be the arbiter of this. You need to have, you know, the General Assembly needs to have a part here. So if I'm to draw a parallel here on that, and that bill was, I think, defeated or knocked down, am I to understand that the OPM secretary would suddenly be the, or initially be the arbiter of this much housing policy, or am I reading that wrong?
They will be the arbiter. The one good thing that came out of it is right before it passed in the House, a amendment was added, which allowed that the whatever the allocations are will go back to the Housing Committee and the Planning Development Committee and to the entire legislature to vote on it. So that is welcome news. Again, if we don't change the, you know, we could describe what the original policy was in the last 2 years as reckless. Mm-hmm. And if they don't change that, it'll be really concerning. So we're hoping that they will, the cooler heads will prevail, that they'll be much more thoughtful. But what's written in the bill language does not specify. So there's a lot of air in there and daylight in there into understanding how it's going to actually play out. So we're going to watch it closely.
Okay, so as far as you and your attorneys and everybody who's read this, it does look like, Maria, you're saying that there will have to be at least some direct input by legislators on some aspects of this.
Correct. Once OPM has decided what their numbers are, they have to go back to the legislature with those numbers. And then, you know, we will all have some daylight on what's happening.
So OPM then will be, as you can read this, the structure here, Maria, then OPM will take a look at each individual municipality and then each individual municipality's allocation or whatever number there is, that will then be assessed individually by the legislature, or do we know?
We don't know. So what's written in the bill language is the same bill language we had for the last 2 years, which did none of that. It basically just said, okay, so we're going to look at your town only in the sense of what is your grand list, what is your poverty level in your town, what is your income, average income level in your town, and what is your percentage of multifamily that you have. And that's it. And that's how they made an allocation. And it didn't matter whether you're a dense area or whether, you know, you have wetlands or whatever. None of those other things, local, whether you have capacity for sewer, whether you have school capacity, none of those things were considered. So jobs, whether there's any opportunity in the community, you know where it's is it closer to Metro New York where you might have more demand? None of those things were factored in those original allocations. So we have to, you know, see what happens. But if we're just following the letter of the bill, and we saw that, interestingly enough, the day of the vote, the woman who was the proponent, Erin Boggs, sent a letter to all of the legislators in the Senate saying, hey, we have our allocation system, so you can go ahead and use that. It's the same one that was rejected 2 years in a row, and she's encouraging our senators to use it again.
So, Maria, it almost sounds like, and I might be reading this wrong, but am I wrong to say there's kind of the framework of a state-level planning and zoning commission here or not? Is that the avenue we're walking down here?
Well, a little bit. In terms of what you're being mandated to build as affordable units, yes. But at the end of the day, even the way the other bill was written, it said, but we're going to give you the number. You just decide how and where you're going to put it. So, you know, that's the way they'll get around saying, you know, it's still local control because you get to decide where.
Got it.
But when it's an onerous number, and it's concerning because, you know, if I take any town, like I could take New Canaan, which is where I live, they assigned us 1,350 units in New Canaan. Now, and they've said that, oh, you won't have to build it. You can have a developer build it. Well, if a developer builds, they have to make sure the deal pencils out. So if they're building, they're never going to build all affordable. It just won't pencil out. So they'll build 90% afford 90% market value, with 10% being irreaffordable.
Yeah, I
so
got it.
When you do that, you're doubling your entire housing stock in your town. That's literally with you know, apartments essentially. Yeah, those were the numbers that we've seen in the last 2 years, which is why it didn't pass in the last 2 years. So, you know, that's so we have a lot to know about what's actually how it's going to actually go forward. And we hope that, that some cooler heads will prevail, that the governor, since he has oversight of OPM, you know, we'll see where they kind of follow through
All right.
Making sure that it makes sense locally.
The website, ct169strong.org. Maria Weingarten. Maria, thank you. And I guess round two is yet to come. Maria, thanks. We'll be in touch.
Great. Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right. There you go. So they say there's a study now. And so this is interesting. So the Office of Policy and Management, the OPM director, which is an appointed person, not an elected person, the director of OPM, under this bill that was passed in the waning hours of the General Assembly, is going to head up the process of determining, at least at the state level, and these numbers will have to be, as Maria said, voted on by the General Assembly, how many units of or how many aggregate units of housing should be added to your city and town, and how many of those are going to be affordable units. Interesting. Ah, the plot thickens. All right, and we'll start hearing about that next January. That'd probably be issue one in the short session coming up. So we will keep you up to date on this, kids. The website, though, ct169strong.org, the housing bill that did pass, you know, has some innocuous stuff about, you know, keeping landlords, you know, competent and keeping them to their contractual obligations, which is fine. Everybody loves that. Mandated walkthroughs, the fine structure against landlords has been changed. That's all good. But again, the battle continues over. It's a simple question. How much control over local zoning issues should the state have versus the people in the city or town or those who sit on or chair a local planning or zoning commission? And you remember right off the start of the program here at 2 o'clock, of course you were with me back then, 2.5 hours ago, we had New York Governor Kathy Hochul, we had New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy saying, well, obviously, the Canadian wildfires, it's all to do with climate change. Is it? Or is it poor forest management, a combination of the two? We always get this political fight when we have wildfires. Our next guest has a few thoughts on that. He served in the Trump administration as the Senate-confirmed general counsel of the U.S. Department of Transportation, November of 2017 to January of 2021. During the Bush 43 administration, he served as the principal deputy and acting assistant attorney general for the Office of Legal Counsel at the Department of Justice. Currently distinguished fellow and executive at the Vice President's Office of the Heritage Foundation. Stephen Bradbury is the guest. Stephen, hi, it's Paul at WICC. How are you?
Hey, Paul, thanks.
And
good to be here.
Thanks for coming on short notice here, Stephen. Well, you know, we seem to get this all the time. Oh, it's definitely global warming. But I also, Stephen, read some interesting things about forest management here and what some states in this country or some provinces in Canada do or don't do when it comes to that. Talk a little about that.
Yes. Well, like so often happens, government policies have a direct effect. And here you have liberal forest management policies in these Canadian provinces, where they're not going in and clearing out the underbrush. They're not doing controlled burns to try to alleviate the fuel, which is the dry, tender wood that's catching fire in these dry conditions. And just as we've seen in California, that would go a long way toward mitigating the effects of these wildfires. But let me say,
sure,
that's not the only direct cause here. We're also into an El Nino event where the surface temperatures in the Pacific are rising, and that causes a change in global weather patterns that affect weather in North America. And that's linked to the wetter weather we saw this past winter in the Southeast, including in California, all that record snowfall in the Sierras. Meanwhile, in the Northeast up here, we're having drier conditions, and that comes with El Nino. And so the forests in Canada are dried out. So the direct causes are pretty clear. It's El Nino and it's poor forest management.
And Stephen, who pushes back? I try and make sense of this all the time when this happens. The clearing out of the underbrush and the control burns sound like good policy. Hey, you start a small fire, you get rid of some of the fuel, and then, you know, you mitigate the lightning strikes and the other causes here. Who pushes back on doing this if it's sound policy?
Well, environmentalists push back, for one. Radical environmentalists don't want anybody to touch the forests. They don't like human management of the forest that contradicts their philosophy. So that's a factor. Also, of course, budget considerations. It costs less if you do less. Forest management doesn't come cheap. And then, you know, there are a lot of housing developments close to forests. That's certainly what we see in California. And nobody likes to see the big trucks going in and all the activity. And so there's, you know, not in my backyard, local pushback. So it's a combination, but it's definitely a liberal government policy not to do this. That's sort of a policy push,
Stephen,
on the liberal side.
Stephen Bradbury is the guest, distinguished fellow in the executive vice president's office at the Heritage Foundation. Stephen, from being in the news business, I also read when this sort of thing happens in California, right? And you and I know it happens every year. It's amazing. When you read that, a lot of these fires, like the ones in California and other northwestern states, are sparked by power company equipment, and they have to end up spending hundreds of millions making a restitution, making people whole again.
Yes, it's a huge strain on the power companies. At the same time, of course, in California, they're forcing those companies to close down fossil fuel-fired power plants, like gas-powered plants. So they are getting it from both sides. It's a real squeeze that's going on. Let me say one other thing, I think, for your listeners that's relevant here. We hear from the media, of course, the first thing coming out of their mouths, and also from politicians, as you said, is this is climate change. This is climate change. This is caused by human activity releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Well, the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, in all their reports and forecasts, they do not claim a link, and they don't say they have found a link between climate change or the release of carbon dioxide and wildfire activities. Mm. So this is an assumed link, a conclusion people jump to. And I will also say that in the media, many of these newspapers and media companies have taken a pledge. It's shocking to know about. They've taken a pledge that they will not publish articles or report news that contradicts the climate change theories. So they actually censor themselves, and they will not come out with stories that get into the real causes of some of these things. They'll just repeat stories and report the news as if it's clear and concluded without, you know, beyond dispute that this is connected to human release of carbon dioxide.
Yeah. Stephen, finally, and also, you know, one point finally, Stephen, that some people mention, but not enough people take into consideration, lightning strikes. I mean, Mother Nature. I mean, how many of these wildfires I read in mainstream publications are attributed to lightning every year?
Right. So, well, that's right. Of course, they're natural. These are natural events throughout the history of the world. Forests burn when they get dry and when lightning strikes. And that's a natural process. And then they renew themselves. They grow back. Of course, they do pose a threat to health and to the well-being of civilization when we've got, you know, our lots of development close by. And so that's why forest management is important, so that we sort of minimize the size and effects of these natural events.
Check out heritage.org, as we always advise you to, heritage.org. Stephen Bradbury has been the guest. Stephen, thank you. Appreciate the time. Take care, and we'll talk down the road.
Very good. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. There you go, folks. So, again, let's not buy the, and as Stephen just said, the UN has never had a direct link or said there's an indefatigable direct link between out-of-control, you know, brush fires and forest fires and climate change. Not that climate change isn't happening, but let's take a breath here. We check in with a guy behind onlyinbridgeport.com. Lenny Grimaldi is with us. Lenny, good afternoon. How are you?
Hey, Uncle Polly, what's going on?
I'm good, Lenny. So first of all, before we get into stuff, talk to me about this new podcast you have. What's this going on?
Oh, this podcast, so it's a limited-run podcast based on my book called Chased, Alone, Black, and Undercover. And it really tells the story of a black undercover cop who becomes a law enforcement test tube for white privilege. Billy Chase went where no black man had gone before, infiltrating a faction of the Gambino crime family in Lower Fairfield County.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a deeper social element to the story about a man completely losing his identity. And it's a really tragic story. So it's a 10-part podcast. If you want to go to onlyinbridgeport.com, you can click on the Chased podcast, and you can listen to all these episodes. It was a fun time doing it. It took a couple of years putting it together, and I got COVID delayed, but we finally kicked it out the door.
Excellent. So go to onlyinbridgeport.com. Of course, the podcast, multi-part podcast, Chased. Now to our topics for today, Len, and I guess we start off with that big Steel Point luxury development is on track, correct?
Yes. Yeah, so the Steel Point redevelopment project, the next phase of it, are these hundreds of luxury units along the waterfront, and it received the environmental clearance from the state. So it looks like they're going to be breaking ground probably mid-July or so,
mm-hmm.
and hopefully they're off to the races. This is something that's very different for Bridgeport. I mean, these are luxury units, and, you know, we've talked about it before, and you touched earlier about the affordable housing issue.
Yeah, yeah.
You just can't have affordable housing. You need luxury apartments and dwellings to support the businesses and the restaurants in the community. So it's going to bring a new dimension to the city. I think it's a really good thing. These are going to be exceptional units. So hopefully they'll break ground next month, and you know, within a year or two, they'll be the hundreds of units and plus a new hotel added with it.
So Lenny, is the target here maybe affluent retiree or younger person to try and keep them away from, say, Stamford, Norwalk, maybe where the traffic's a little better, they can still jump on the train? Who's the target for these units?
Yeah, I mean, good point. It's definitely people with discretionary income who can pay, you know, $3,000, $3,500 per unit or maybe even more.
Mm-hmm.
That's a general kind of range. But you're on a transportation nexus. You know, you're very, very close. You're right on the harbor. You know, you're close to the ferry. You're, you know, close to the train station. So it's kind of a new dimension for the city of recapturing its waterfront. And if any of your listeners haven't been to Steel Point,
mm-hmm.
go there. You got a Bass Pro Shops. You got the Boca Oyster Bar. You've got a public boardwalk that's exceptional, you know, to walk along the waterfront. It's quite a place. I mean, it took decades and decades to get this started, but now it's finally rolling.
Also, Lenny,
yeah, I think you're talking about bringing people from Lower Fairfield County to Bridgeport, definitely.
Absolutely. Lenny Grimaldi is the guest, only in Bridgeport.com. Lenny, also the state delegation in Hartford, they did their job, right? They brought home some of the bacon for Bridgeport, especially, wink, wink, in an election year.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the final days of the legislative session, and it's like a controlled frenzy, for lack of better words.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so much is swirling at the end. And whether it's Joe Ganim or any other mayor trying to put a budget together, it's a leap of faith. because the city budget process ends before the state budget fiscal situation ends. So you're kind of like plugging in these numbers and holding your breath that the numbers we plug in are going to hold up based on what's coming back from the state. So the city's legislative delegation, which, you know, had been a laughingstock for years, has really got its act together. You know, a lot of smart, you know, people representing Bridgeport in the legislature, and there, a lot of them are in significant positions that have strong relationships with the state leaderships, particularly Matt Ritter, the Speaker of the House. It's really important for the delegation to have a solid relationship with Ritter because they really serve as the bridge between the mayor's office and the state and what comes back. So, yeah, this what they're able to bring back is really good news for Ganim's budget. So he should be sending them roses in the cases.
And I guess, Len, there's going to be enough money now to go ahead with the arena upgrades and renovations. I know those were stalled because the bid came in too high. Is that full speed ahead now?
Yeah. So they also brought back $15 million, $15 million to help upgrade the city arena, which is now a little over 20 years old.
Yeah.
And what that does is helps solidify the anchor tenant, the Bridgeport Islanders, which is the farm team of the New York Islanders. So that was one of the conditions that the Islanders wanted to continue to be the anchor tenant at the arena. So that's good news as well. So that solidifies that.
Before we get to your former boss, Mr. Trump, and what may happen to him, because we know we follow that like a soap opera, the whole housing thing, Len, at the end, we were chatting with the other folks about this today. I know you've been following this. Marilyn Moore, Senate Chair of Housing on the Democratic side. Not anything crazy, but the whole affordable housing thing, you know, Len, we talk about it, and we all know this is aimed primarily at lower Fairfield County, so I guess they took a baby step with this bill.
Yeah, I think this is one of those, hey, I'm running for mayor, let me save face, because this thing was dead. I mean, it wasn't really going anywhere. So this came together at the end, as a lot of issues do. You know, it's really crazy the last few days, a real swirl. So that's my sense of it. Give me something I can bring back for my run for mayor. And that's really what it is. I don't see it much more than that because, you know, there's no real meat on the bones on this thing right now. And it's going to take some time to get there. And as you discussed earlier, it's not very organized. It's kind of like you can read into it a variety of different ways. So this thing has to really get tightened up before it's going to move forward.
Lenny, finally, your old boss, Mr. Trump, every week we talk, Len, it's shocking. He's in the news for something, and now I guess we're seeing where the legal walls may again be closing in on him. And, you know, I mean, I know he's still leading with about 38% or 40% in the Republican polls, but Len, you wonder if all this is suddenly maybe not, but if it, you know, chips away at his support here. I don't know.
Well, it doesn't help. I mean, so basically, what we're talking about is the Justice Department informed Donald Trump's legal team that he's a target in the federal investigation into mishandling of classified documents. So, I mean, just looking at this, it sounds like he's going to be charged. And it's kind of like really open up the floodgates for the Republican primary process. You know, Trump thrives on, you know, divide and conquer chaos, right?
Yeah.
But I think it's going to get so chaotic that it's going to open the door for some Republican candidates to say, listen, this guy cannot win a general election. And I think that's going to be kind of their leverage to try to break through the static. I mean, to me, the guy to watch out for is Tim Scott.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, he's doing what you talked about, Gavin Newsom. You did. Well, he's going on the liberal shows too,
yeah,
right? He's going on The View and stuff.
That View appearance he did, Len, the other day, that would have been good down the street at the WWE. Man, he got into it there, and he didn't stop. Good for him.
Yeah, he's not afraid to mix it up, right? So that's what I'm talking about. I mean, you never know. One of these other candidates could catch fire, but also, how many candidates are in this thing now? 8, 10, 12? I don't know. There could be a lot more.
I think, Len, hold on. I think there's 37 from what I see here. But go ahead.
Yeah, I think, you know, if people see, you know, Trump dying in the gooey death here, more are going to get in. So, you know, why not? You know,
yeah.
But it's, you know, who knows how it's going to shake up. But this is not good for him at all.
No. Lenny Grimaldi, check it out, only in Bridgeport.com, regularly for the site. And his new multi-part podcast is there that Len spent years putting together. Slowed down a little by COVID, but it's up there now. Len, thanks once again. Good to hear from you. We'll chat next week. Thank you.
All right. See you next week. Thanks.
Thank you, sir. Lenny Grimaldi, only in Bridgeport.com. All right. As a rather famous syndicated radio program host once said years and years ago in a very famous blooper reel that you can hear on YouTube, it's ponderous, man. It's just blanking ponderous. Hi, good afternoon. What am I talking about? Well, the fact that when you look at all the smiling faces in Hartford and all the people in the General Assembly, everybody's like, hey, look at what we did, which is good. We actually got a budget done. Our financial house, our fiscal house is actually in order, as opposed to the, you know, the usual cha-cha, the usual beating of the breast and beating of the forehead and, you know, banging our heads up against a wall saying, what tax are we going to raise here and what tax are we going to raise there? If we learned anything, and I think you should learn a little something from mostly anything, you know, if we learned anything over the past, three weeks here in all the budget talks in Hartford and the tax cuts and everything, if we learned anything, two things. When you have money, when you have at least decent finances, or in this case, a pretty sizable surplus, and you have people acting like adults, and you have a lot of new people in Hartford getting rid of what I like to refer to, at least in a political sense, not the personal sense. I know very few of these people personally. But when you get rid of the political dead wood, you know, the old phrase dead wood, like the pins that used to be knocked down, had to be cleared out manually by the pin boys and pin girls there at the old bowling alleys years and years ago before the automatic pin machines. Clear out the deadwood. You know, when you get new attitudes in Hartford, even when the leadership is the same, and you have, you have a surplus, and you recognize that it's, you know, kind of sort of time to give people back something, you know, everybody is smiling like the governor was. Give you a little bit of this here to start us off on a Thursday. This courtesy of our friends at CTN, the Connecticut Network. The governor gave short comments earlier today regarding the close of the General Assembly session and the first time in years that we've had a budget that everybody can smile upon. They actually gave some money back to you and I. It's amazing, isn't it? So everybody was in full kumbaya mode this morning.
Like, I want to say in all seriousness, a job well done. You had a hard time figuring out whether pizza is our state delicacy, but we'll get to that. Our Bears dodged a bullet. A lot of hot air. We don't have to worry about the helium. But I want to say in all seriousness, in particular what you did on the budget, getting that done on time with such strong bipartisan support, I think sends a message. That I love watching that board when it's all green on both sides of the aisle. It was really special. Almost 100% in the Senate, pretty darn close. And I also tell you, that was due to the leadership working on both sides of the aisle, working together very collaboratively. I love watching the chairman and the rankings working together, finding common ground, and it's special. And don't take it for granted. I mean, I look around the country. California's got deficits in the tens of billions of dollars, and Oregon is having a hard time getting their senators even to show up, and even Congress is locked down again right now. Hope that's briefly. And I think you showed us a different way. And I think you showed us the Connecticut way, and I'm really proud of that. And with that, let me just go to my prepared remarks, if you don't mind. Have a good night. You really deserved it.
All right, so just a couple of quick comments there from Governor Lamont. Again, a guy who gets it, and look, you can disagree with the guy on whatever you do, and I call the guy out when I think he is wrong on social issues or has some screwed up priorities. But you know, it's right. It was a pleasure to see. And this has got to be the first time in, I don't know, 8, 10, 12, 15, 20 years where we didn't. Now, look, it's the political process. I understand that. You're going to see darts lobbed at each other. But isn't it amazing what the state can get done? And I know it's easy when you have a surplus. But isn't it amazing what the state can get done? Geez, I don't know, when we act like adults. Now, make no mistake. The reason this happened relatively easily, there was some rancor over the past couple of weeks. But my big point here is this. Even in a blue state like Connecticut, you need a viable two-party system, or at least a system where the wishes of the minority party, in this case, the Republicans in the state, is respected by the governor, you know, like Ned Lamont, not like some guy bouncing around the state of Maine right now. You know, in Ned Lamont, you actually have a guy who looks at fiscal issues a little clearly, a little differently than his predecessors. And in that, he was able to latch on to a lot of, perish the thought, Republican ideas in this state. And look, you know that there's never going to be a conservative policy in Connecticut on abortions or guns or urban policy. It's just not going to happen. But where the rubber meets the road in this state is dollars and cents, money. And at least right now, for another 3 or so years, second term, we've got a guy, I think, that understands. And maybe this is his business background. Maybe this is his lower Fairfield County background. You've got a guy here that is not an automatic no, like a guy in Maine, excuse me. What a disaster he was. So it's quite heartening to me to see this, and it should be to you. Now, is it going to get tough in the next few years? Yeah, we're going to run deficits again, probably. But that's up, down, up, down, up, down. And a bigger point on this is to the following. Looking ahead to 2024, and I know we're going to say, oh, what are you worried about that now? No, it's only next year. Again, pay attention. Pay attention to who your state rep is, your member of the state house, your state representative is, one of 151 men and women in the state house, and then take a look at who your state senate member is, one of 36 men and women in the state senate, and understand, and I try and drive this home to you over and over and over again, this is where the rubber meets the road. Yeah, the governor has a lot of say, and this cycle around, the governor seemed to be at least a little more receptive to some Republican ideas, because Ned Lamont's a dollar and cents guy, at least in his business sense. You know that, right? I don't have to tell you that. Even people who analyze him say, yeah, I mean, the Wall Street Journal praised the guy. When was the last time the Wall Street Journal praised a Connecticut Democrat for doing anything, right? I think we were using cassettes back then. I think I still had 8-tracks at my mother's house, as somebody pointed out the other day. We're talking about music formats here. But, you know, when Newsweek says a few weeks ago, hey, not for nothing, but Ned Lamont, when it comes to the monetary policy of Connecticut, he's pretty much a Republican. So there you go. So maybe that's the formula. But I will say this again. And before we go to the phones here at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC, understand that the fact that this stuff got done in Hartford relatively easily, there were some arguments there, but it just shows that this state runs the best when you have both sides contributing here, the Republican side and the Democratic side. Now, the Democrats, at least for the future, are going to have the chairmanships of all the committees, because that's how it works. And the Republicans are the ranking members, in case you're not fully understanding what that term is. But Governor Lamont mentioned it just a few seconds ago in those comments on CTN earlier today. You have the chairmen, the chairpersons, and the ranking members. And that helps when people are convinced that it's okay to vote for a Republican. So, again, part of the onus is on you Republican voters in the state. You Republicans who, in particular, tend to buck what the conventioners decide. You tend to force primaries, and you tend to support people who are unelectable. They may be fine people. They may have wonderful families. They may be able to raise scads of money. But when you support unelectable people, you're turning a lot of people off to the conservative and Republican message. When you have some people with the R in front of them or the red sash in front of them who are not, you know, far right wing reactionaries, you actually can elect those people and get stuff done. It's not hard. It's not hard, but think and choose wisely. I will say it again, and I will continue to say it to and through, you know, 2024 and years to come. Let's be careful who Connecticut votes for and understand, like I've always said to you over and over again, and I'll say it one more time, where the rubber really meets the road is not an unelectable Senate candidate. They're not unelectable constitutional officer candidates in this state. It's with the people who can actually win races for the state house and the state senate.